For generations, Bethlehem Steel defined, employed, and built the Lehigh Valley, as well as much of America. Dr. Jill Shenham's new book, As Goes Bethlehem, Steelworkers and the Restructuring of an Industrial Working Class, is a powerful and moving story of the last generation of American steelworkers, sharing the workers' own voices and reflections. And it is the story of what has happened to the industrial working class in this country, and why, as we've moved to a post-industrial society. Shenham, a professor of sociology and anthropology at County College of Morris in Randolph, New Jersey, will also offer an author's talk on As Goes Bethlehem on Saturday, February 17th at 1 p.m. at the National Museum of Industrial History, located on the Steel Stacks campus in the former electrical repair shop of the Bethlehem Steel Plant. This is WDIY 88.1 Lehigh Valley Public Radio, and you are tuned in to Lehigh Valley Arts Salon. I remain Kate Scuffle, your host, and this evening I'm joined by Dr. Jill Shenham. Welcome, Jill.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming in, and congratulations on the book.
Oh, thank you very much.
What was not only the inspiration for the book, but your journey into the community of the Bethlehem Steel community here in town?
So I worked in Bethlehem in the mid-1990s, overseeing a program, Life Path, that provided group homes and day programs for adults and children with developmental disabilities. And while I was working here, some of the staff who reported to me were married to steel workers. I heard about what was going on in their families. Anywhere in and around Bethlehem, of course, you saw this giant steel mill. So I became really fascinated in that. I left that job after I had my second child and got a job at County College of Morris and was able then to go back and finish my PhD at the Graduate Center of CUNY. And so I knew that for my dissertation research, I really wanted to come back to Bethlehem and find out what happened.
The book sounds as if it's a mix of interviews, reflections, voices of the steelworkers, and also you then stepping back and shaping that and introducing the arc of their journey. But it's an interesting one. I mean, they are not only the last generation of steelworkers, but within that generation, within their working lives, it encapsulated this entire post-World War II change, and an incredibly dramatic change.
Yeah, and so for me, it was really interesting picking this cohort of steelworkers, mm-hmm. right? The groups that were hired in 63, 64, 73, 74, and the last big hiring at Bethlehem Steel was 78, 79. And the way that steel industry hires is in these waves of hiring. So you sort of get these cohorts or age grades that move through their careers together. And so those would be the workers that were there in the 1990s when the plant closed,
right?
So those were the workers that I was interested in finding out more about. Those were also a lot of the workers that were around, right?
Yeah.
And then in terms of like interviewing, et cetera, I'm a cultural anthropologist. So what that means is that I use a method of participant observation where I have to meet steelworkers, spend time with them, go to events like meetings and reunions and picnics and, unfortunately, more lately, funerals, and also like observe and interview. So it's really a method that combines participation and interview and reading and talking to people. And one thing that was great for me when I started doing this research in like 2008, 2009, is that picking the topic of what happened at Bethlehem Steel just resonated with the people I was speaking with. They really wanted to explore what happened also. It was very important to them. So it was such a meaningful opportunity to think about this long process of deindustrialization that had affected them so tremendously.
It seems like, so for them, they also had an interest in exploring what had happened. It wasn't a sense of, let me tell you what happened, but we need to talk about this.
Mm-hmm.
Because I would think it would have felt like it was happening at them, too. It must have been part of that,
I think,
of not having control in it.
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah.
Not having complete control, but trying to navigate a trajectory that would be best for them and their families.
Uh-huh.
And one thing I write about in the book is that, of course, they wanted to do that, right? And hold on to as many of these Fortis benefits like pension plans and health cares and as they could. But the terrain of deindustrialization was so contradictory, so confusing, so they didn't have access to all the kinds of knowledge that they would have had access to make informed decisions. So it became very frustrating to try to make these decisions that are best for one's family, but not really having sufficient information to be able to do so.
And in the book you talk about, and it's kind of getting, we're looking at the end game in a sense here, but that sad end game of trying to navigate once this is kind of set in motion, the deindustrialization path, the downsizing of the steel, et cetera, does it become then a choice of trying to, as you said, hold on to benefits, hold on to health care? And the national landscape wasn't supportive of that. This reflected a national change, it seemed, didn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. This is a gigantic transformation in society that applies to so many different industries. So in my book, I sort of talk about the Fordist era, right, which is, you know, that whole concept comes out of the Ford assembly line, where Ford produced these cheap cars on an assembly line with de-skilled labor, but he also paid his workers more so that they could actually purchase the cars. So this kind of became the model for post-World War II, the whole social order of post-World War II. And what, you know, some scholars would say, like Antonio Gramsci, who's a famous Italian scholar, is that whole way, that whole regime of accumulation or way of structuring society impacted every aspect of people's lives, the way they experienced work, the way their families were structured, the way their communities were set up. So we've seen the transformation from that to the contemporary, we could call it a post-industrial or post-Fordist era of like flexible jobs, flexible works, attack on unions, emphasis on personal responsibility. So these workers saw that entire transition play itself out over 40 years in their lives.
That has to be hard not to internalize, too, and feel like you didn't navigate it well, or how could this be happening to me? It's interesting. And so that shift, the post-Ford, you know, moment, the one we're living in now, how does that affect communities? How does that affect a sense of investment in the work or the ability to buy the product? It seems short-sighted in some ways. Quick, fast, but short-sighted.
Yeah, I mean, I think it has implications for almost every aspect of people's lives also. So I think that we get the rise of big box stores like Walmart that sell cheaper products that aren't produced in the United States. It drives its suppliers to China where they can use cheaper labor. And because there are so many working class Americans that can't afford to buy goods that are more expensive. So you don't really have that same mass consumption market, and that's affected everything, right? The way goods are produced, the way they're marketed, the way they're sold. And then workplaces are very different. One thing I thought was so fascinating interviewing so many workers was a lot of these workers moved from their jobs at the steel into these kind of new economy jobs. Mm-hmm. And they are like, it was like they were seeing these for the first time. So sort of most of us get acclimated to this new order very gradually. And they were seeing like boom. And that was fascinating because they had a lot of critiques of this new kind of work that, you know, I think people who get used to it sort of don't see that. All kinds of critiques, right? Like they said, you know, work is short term, it's unstable, management regimes are just much more despotic. People are surveilling you and disciplining you all the time. The unions, if you have them, are very weak. Turnover is very high. Job insecurity is very great. Workers don't feel this kind of solidarity at a lot of these jobs they went to, but people are kind of individualistic and out for themselves and competitive, right? So they had this kind of critique of new kinds of jobs that was interesting also. And some of it reminded me of kind of the pre-union era at Bethlehem Steel. Like steel workers would say that stories would be passed down before the union came in and got strong, that older workers wouldn't teach younger workers skills because they didn't have seniority and job security. So if they taught these younger workers their skills, the younger workers could replace them. So you can see how, you know, the union state inside the mill that really recognizes seniority and recognizes this kind of solidarity, it also builds and encourages solidarity. Workers now can teach younger workers. They can share their skills. They can...
Which would probably serve to create a better product and a more stable environment and all the rest of it. That's interesting.
Yeah.
We were talking a little bit before we went on the air. I come, I'm from Pittsburgh and from Homestead, and I know, you know, the sense of unions, depending on how you talk to, would be, oh, seniority is about guaranteeing people jobs so they'll be lazy, or it's destroying competition. And that's a very different way of kind of looking at what it really does. We're going to a break soon, but when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about that. I do want to mention to our listeners that to remind them that you will also be talking about the book at the National Museum of Industrial History on February 17th. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct, at 1 o'clock.
And that is free with museum admission and a perfect setting. I love that it's at the former electric repair shop of the plant.
Yeah.
So I think this book particularly speaks not only to changes in the country, but so intimately and personally to Bethlehem. I would encourage our listeners. That's again February 17th at 1 o'clock at the National Museum of Industrial History. That's on the Steel Stacks campus, and that will be in the former electrical repair shop at Bethlehem Steel. You're listening to Lehigh Valley Arts Salon on WDIY 88.1. I'm your host, Kate Scuffle, and I've been talking with Dr. Jill Shenham about her new book, As Goes Bethlehem, Steelworkers and the Restructuring of an Industrial Working Class, published by Vanderbilt University Press, and about her upcoming author's talk at the National Museum of Industrial History. We'll be right back after this short break.
For program support, we thank Lehigh Valley Style, the magazine the Valley lives by, celebrating the people, places, and things unique to our region. Subscribe today or view the digital edition online at lehighvalleystyle.com.
Welcome back to Lehigh Valley Arts Salon here on WDIY 88.1, Lehigh Valley Public Radio. I'm your host, Kate Scuffle, and tonight I'm talking with Dr. Jill Shenham about her new book, As Goes Bethlehem, Steelworkers and the Restructuring of an Industrial Working Class. Welcome back, Jill. We were talking a little bit before the break about the process that this last generation of steelworkers lived through, observed in the kind of national change of how industrial work works, the industrial working class. But you were saying it's also been it was a really long process. So even though it was contained within this one generation, what was that like for them?
Yeah, it was a very long process. So unlike the mills in western Pennsylvania, which often closed very quickly, in Bethlehem, this process went on for about 30 years. Restructurings of closing shops and divisions, downsizing areas. So it was a long period when workers had to figure out how to transfer internally within the plant in order to hold on to jobs. And then at the end, as more and more shops and divisions were closing, they had transfer rights to other Bethlehem Steel plants that were within a certain radius. So they had to make decisions about transferring to other plants. But that was very difficult. They would get a letter from Bethlehem Steel and had to decide if they wanted to take that transfer or go to another plant. And often they were trying to work on the information they had, but they didn't have complete information about Sparrows Point or Lackawanna or later Conshohocken and Coatesville. So they were making these decisions as best they could.
Right.
And the goal then was to put in enough time to get their pensions. Pensions a hugely valuable asset that could bring $1,000 to $4,000 a month to workers in their retirement. So it was very important to make the right decision, but they often didn't have enough information to make the right decision.
And I understand from reading a review of the book that, in fact, then often, though, would choose to transfer in hopes of maintaining the benefits of the pension. And then often Sparrows Point, et cetera, were then sold after they had moved, and the new buyer would be like, well, no, your pension's Pension's right. not my problem.
So what workers didn't predict at Bethlehem, they did predict the closing of the mill. They did not predict that an entire gigantic multinational corporation would enter bankruptcy and leave the other side not existent by International Steel Group. So that was a shock. So if workers were working at another plant like Sparrows Point, and at some point in the bankruptcy process, the pension benefits were dumped onto a private public corporation called PBGC. Mm. At that point, their pension clock ended. So I spoke with one worker who was literally 8 days from rolling into his pension when that PBGC transfer took place.
That's amazing. How many of the workers roughly took this risk?
A few thousand.
Okay, okay. And I would think this would be stressful. Did they relocate their families as well?
That was very difficult because only a few steel plants were close enough to commute to from Bethlehem. The, you know, Lackawanna near Buffalo and Sparrows Point was not. So steel workers would rent apartments there and commute back and forth. But it was produced a kind of intimate violence for families because steel workers, first of all, it was very difficult working at the new plant. They didn't have seniority. Mm. They were outsiders. Often the plant workers there resented them. But secondly, they felt like they couldn't fulfill their responsibilities to raising children and being a father and a husband in the family. So their work increasingly became defined as like only being a male breadwinner. And so there were divorces, and it was very hard on families. A lot of families and sort of professional middle class doesn't understand that, but they're very tied to place. And the place of Bethlehem, their kin communities, the kind of reciprocal supports that families and kinship networks can give each other are hugely important. So this kind of uprooting and mobility was extremely hard on workers and their families.
I was going to say it would be what would tear the community apart just as much as a loss of a job.
Yeah.
And just in different ways. And how does this parallel on a national scene what's happening during this time? We've got, I'm again, referring to a wonderful review of the book by Ron Ennis in the Lehigh Valley Labor Council, talking about the stages nationally from Reagan, the Reagan era, through George Bush, the emphasis on bankers and CEOs, the lack of emphasis on protection of the working class or the industrial working class. Was this inevitable? I mean, could things have turned out differently? Because sometimes I feel like coming from a steel community myself, there's this sense that, well, times have changed. You're just being anachronistic. I mean, things have to move on. But it doesn't feel like it had to have been. These were choices that were being made about how we operate as a country.
Yeah, there's huge choices about what are being made. So there's all kinds of governmental decisions. There's policies that support corporations making different kinds of decisions. You know, a lot of steel workers cite Ronald Reagan's firing of the air traffic controllers with that strike as really being a major shift in the way government, corporations, and unions interacted, and sort of being the beginning of this very aggressive attack on unions that we've seen over the past 40 years. There's also, you know, like retraining programs for steel workers through TAA federal programs really were rooted in you could get retraining benefits if your job had been lost due to foreign competition. But that foreign competition was created by decisions that the U.S. state was making, you know, by signing of free trade agreements that encouraged industry to move out of the country, by even the Marshall Plan after World War II that poured money directed at Cold War politics into Japan and Germany, who built greenfield steel mills. So it's much more complicated than it's not natural or inevitable. It is a whole new political and economic regime that's taking the place of earlier regimes. And many people like David Harvey would argue it's really not about increasing productivity in the United States. It's not that steel mills weren't productively producing steel. Mm-hmm. It's about reclaiming class power. It's a political project to reclaim class power of the elite.
That's interesting. And so the working class, again, the working class, which became a kind of a middle class, essentially, because of what the unions won and because of pensions and security and et cetera, people could live a middle class life. assume that their children might do as well or better than them, a kind of upward mobility, the American dream, all these things that are kind of the story we tell ourselves of ourselves, seems to have been what was discarded in this transfer, in this transition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And instead, we tell a story now that it is the personal responsibility of the worker to make the kind of informed choices, to have a flexible resume and market themselves. But I think what many steelworkers would say about their experience in the new economy is that that is an illusion of choice and perhaps an illusion of freedom, that there's a freedom in having the security of a union protecting your rights at work, of pension and health care coverage that you can rely on, of having a long-term relationship with a job or career that you can provide stability and send your child to college if you would like to. So it's a very different concept of freedom than the concept that we hear about today.
And whose freedom it is and who it benefits. Yeah. Yeah. The transition, and in this community, what part of the transition has often been things like healthcare, as well as retail or gig work or hospitality, somewhat education, maybe not. For something like Southside Bethlehem, I mean, you're still involved in the community. People that have friends and activities there. And do you see it surviving this? Is it, I mean, how can I put it? It won't be the same. Does it transition into something more generic? Or what happens in a community like this as these changes continue?
I think some things you see. I mean, Bethlehem is really interesting because it's not your Rust Belt city like Youngstown, Ohio, or, you know, has a robust, diverse economy. But it's an economy in which not everyone has access to the professional middle class jobs, the housing. So at the same time as it's creating professional middle class opportunities, there are lots of working class jobs that are being created here, including the whole warehousing logistics industry, a lot of which is on the site of the old Bethlehem Steel. Mm, mm. And those jobs are not particularly good. They don't have promotional opportunities. They're not super high pay. They're extremely difficult working conditions. They're, for the most part, non-unionized. So you have this real bifurcation and increasing inequality between working class people in Bethlehem and the professional middle class.
Interesting. Just a thought as we're, again, sadly, don't have a lot of time left, but I'm wondering, in the interviews and in talking with the steel workers and their families and families that stay behind when men had to take transfers, etc., what surprised you the most? Surprised or heartened? I don't know which. You tell me.
What I loved the most is I didn't know how complex work was at a steel mill. It's not like an auto factory at all. And hearing people talk about like these diverse skills, the things they could build, the whole variety of different work, the deep and meaningful relationships that they had with coworkers on these teams that had people with all kinds of different skills on them, and the confidence that they felt coming into the mill, that they had control over their work. They had a lot of control over their own work. That, to me, was very, very hopeful, and it was a picture of a much more egalitarian workplace and time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's interesting. I actually remember, again, growing up in Homestead in Pittsburgh, hearing older adults talking with great pride about knowing how to know when the steel needed poured or when the temperature was just right and didn't even need to use an instrument. And those college boys needed to, but they didn't, kind of thing. And it was just a deep sense of ownership and pride, deep pride.
Mm-hmm.
Again, the book by Jill Shenham is As Goes Bethlehem. And we've been talking about the restructuring of the industrial working class in this country. Jill, thank you for joining us today. Again, I will remind our listeners that Jill will be at the National Museum of Industrial History on February 17th at 1 o'clock, offering an author's talk on the book. Any last thoughts before we go?
I just really want to thank the Steelworkers Archives and all of the steelworkers who contributed their knowledge to the book.
Mm-hmm. And thank you. This has been Lehigh Valley Art Salon. I'm still your host, Kate Scuffle. I've been talking today with Dr. Jill Shenham about her book, As Goes Bethlehem, Steelworkers and the Restructuring of an Industrial Working Class. Thank you again, Jill, and thank you to our listeners. I look forward to visiting with you again right here in the Lehigh Valley Arts Salon. If you enjoyed this program, please go to WDIY.org or the WDIY app to share or become a WDIY member.